Good evening. My name is Seamus O'Connor, and I'm an alcoholic. It's nice to be introduced by an Englishman, isn't it? When I first started in AA, and somebody asked me to speak, and I remember my sponsor pointed out the three rules for speaking. You tell how it was, and then you tell what happened, and then you tell what it's like now. So that's as good a formula as I can think of to follow. So what it was like, I'm from a place close to Ireland called Northern Ireland. Political joke. But anyway, and my family is not, in fact, neither of my parents was alcoholic, and but they were both children of alcoholics, if that has anything got to do with anything. And my principal problem growing up was that I had no clue in the world what it was I wanted to do with my life. I was so lost. I went through school, and it was a pretty good school, but you know, by the time I was 17 and people said, well, what are you going to do now with your life? I didn't know what I was going to do with my life, you know. Win a Nobel Prize, you know, I mean, what do you know at 17 about what you want to do with your life? And yet, you know, they were asking me this question. So I looked around, and there wasn't anything I really was interested in. And I decided I would go to seminary, which seemed as good a choice as anything, so I went to a seminary where people studied for the priesthood, and I thought, well, I'll stay here until I get a bachelor's degree in philosophy, and then I can leave. And then I stayed, and then I stayed, and 7 years later they ordained me. And, you know, that may sound kind of callous, but that's about how much conscious intention. I mean, I thought I was unique, but, you know, since I've been in recovery, I've heard a lot of people say, you know, I really never intended to have two or three kids, but, you know, one day I woke up and I'm walking through Kmart and I've got three kids with me, you know, and like, you know, how the hell did this happen, you know, to a nice gal or a nice guy like me, you know, and, but, you know, it's amazing the things we do without really, like, being informed and thinking seriously, what does this mean for my, you know, it's like, well, yeah, it sounds like a good idea, okay, I'll try that, you know, and so I wound up in Sacramento, California, ordained a priest, and it wasn't very long till I began to suspect that that was not a really good decision. You know, at first there's all the novelty of a new country, and there's the novelty of, like, you know, people calling you father and all these, you know, and you get, you know, but once you get past the cross-dressing, you know, then you kind of have to ask yourself, you know, is this what I really want to do, you know? And you know, there's some of that novelty, you know, only lasts so long. So I wound up figuring my best way out was to try to get a promotion. So I worked like hell. I taught in high school. I did this and that and the other thing. And finally, I got sent off for 5 years graduate school to Washington, D.C. Now, what might seem odd about this to some of you is you might think this is something that I did drunk. I had not started drinking yet. So when they told me when I came in AA that I had a problem with sanity, you know, I kind of, okay, I cannot blame alcohol or drugs for my insanity. But I began to drink pretty heavy, and by 1968, this is like 3 or 4 years after I started to drink, I was already drinking a quart of Old Granddad 100 proof a day. And I was, you know, I was in pretty good shape still. I was like 20-something, and, you know, I could recover in the morning, so I wasn't like shaking or anything. I was just, you know, my eyes were bloodshot, but, I mean, what's Visine for? I mean, you know, so, you know, I was like being selected for this, you know, the star priest, you know, and I'm drinking a quart of booze a day in order to live with myself. And finally, in 1968, I realized that something was happening. I didn't think it was the alcohol. I just thought I was neurotic as hell. And I called this priest, though, in Sacramento from Washington, and I said, you know, I'm not feeling good, and, you know, I knew he was in AA, funny enough. And I called him, and he says, how's your drinking? And I said, well, I'm drinking a lot, but I don't... He says, why don't you go to AA? Try AA. So I tried, you know, I was really reluctant to try AA. First of all, I was studying psychology, and I was a priest. And here's AA, it's kind of amateur psychology, amateur religion, you know. And besides, it's probably Protestant anyway, you know. So, you know, so it was like, you know, but reluctantly I went to a meeting, you know, and I sat there, and I never heard that there was a book till the second meeting. I went back to another meeting, and you know, if you're in graduate school and you find out that the professor has a book, you don't go to class, you know, because, you know, the book is on for the exam, you know. So so I started doing the home study program in AA. You know, I figured I could do this at home. The slow ones needed to come to these classes here, you know. I could do it in my room, you know. And so a couple of weeks later, I called this priest again, and I said, do you have any other suggestions? This AA isn't working, you know. And he knew enough not to argue with a drunk. You know, you just, it isn't worthwhile. And he says, you're coming home in a couple of weeks. Why don't you come see me, and I've got something else in mind. So he delivered me to a rehab. As soon as I returned to Sacramento in like the end of May 1968, I was in treatment, or as what passed for treatment in those days. We just called them fidget farms. I don't know what you guys call them, but where you went and you dried out and you shook and, you know, you were nervous and everything. So I was in the fidget farm at the time that Robert Kennedy was assassinated, which, you know, it was probably before a lot of people here were born. But that was my first real exposure to sobriety. I stayed there for 30 days, and I left, and, you know, being a smart ass, I thought I knew it all. So, you know, I went to meetings for a while, went back to graduate school, and, you know, was back drinking again, you know, after 7 or 8 months, and things were just as bad as ever, and they dragged me into a detox in Washington, and got through that, and, you know, so almost 3 years, about 2.5 years after I had been in the first place, I was back in a recovery home because I had now returned to Sacramento, finished my doctorate degree. I was now a big shot in the Diocese of Sacramento, and I was out in my car trying to kill myself, leaving the car running. And it's kind of funny how these things, you know, how you can fail at suicide. I had wrecked my own car that day, and I got a loaner. Don't ever count on a loaner to stay running if you're trying to kill yourself. I passed out on the front seat, and the car passed out too. And I woke up about 4 o'clock in the morning and staggered out of the garage, you know, kind of half rummy still with carbon dioxide or carbon monoxide and alcohol and Dexamils, if anybody's old enough to remember what a Dexamil is. It was Dexedrine with Miltown. It was like, you know, they were everywhere in those days. And so, you know, I'm sitting out, you know, this is the image of a priest, right? You know, you're sitting out in the playing field behind the school and listening to the frogs at 4 o'clock in the morning having failed in suicide, you know. And that was my bottom, because that was, you know, to date, and I hope forever, that was my last drinking episode. That was February the 22nd, 1971. And you know, that time I called this, there was a recovery house that was kind of thought of as being like low bottom in Sacramento. It was called Sacramento Recovery House, and the guy who ran it was a graduate of Folsom Prison, real tough nut, and Walter McCusker. He's dead now. And Walter, you know, was very tough. But I remember calling Walter and saying, you know, before I called him, I even said out, you know, I will do anything this man tells me to do. Because I failed at killing myself. I'm going to have to live till I die. So, you know, I better do something about it, you know. And I called Walter, and he says, come on down. And I went down there, and, you know, they had like 6 bunk beds in a room, you know, and each room. And it was, you know, it wasn't fancy, and it didn't matter. It was like I was ready at that point, you know. And, so, you know, that, but I think when I would ask my sponsor, you know, what do I talk about, you know, at the meetings? And he says, you know, you're such a smart ass. And he says, why don't you just tell them all the ways you've fucked up the program? He said, maybe some people will learn from your mistakes. So, you know, my biggest problem, in a way, all during those 2.5 years, when I was slipping and sliding in and out of AA and in and out of rehabs and detoxes and whatnot, my biggest problem was that I had not listened to what people were telling me. There was guys, you know, who were willing to tell me, you know, and they had 5 or 10 or 15 years, you know, sobriety, and I couldn't hardly get, you know, 6 months. But, you know, I was so dumb and so thick-headed, I would not say, hey, would you tell me what I'm not doing right, you know? So we're all at this AA meeting in the recovery house, and, you know, I'm about 3 days sober, and you know how you can recover as a smartass a lot sooner than you can get sanity back, you know? So I'm sitting there, and we're talking about the insanity of alcoholism. That was the subject. I don't know if any of you have ever had to discuss the insanity of alcoholism. And so here we're all sitting around this table, you know, and we're all losers. You know, we've all been through this thing so many times. There's guys like have been coming back in around 10 years, you know, and they still hadn't got it. And here I was 2.5 years, and I'm this smart guy with a doctorate degree and all of this shit. And I can't stay sober. I'm still in a recovery house waiting for my laundry to come back, you know. And so, you know, how smart can I be, you know? And but we're talking about how insane we were as a result of our alcoholism. And you know what we're saying? We're saying things like, man, I know it's insane because, you know, when I was drinking, this one old guy I remember saying, when I was drinking, man, I remember I left San Bernardino, you know, and I came over the grapevine and I was in Bakersfield and I don't remember anything about the trip. And, you know, somebody else, you know, allowed that they had spent their entire paycheck week after week. And, you know I'm insane. And I'm telling them about how I got my car stuck on the railway tracks parallel to the railway and had to get towed off before FP came along. And, you know, we're all talking about, and finally Walter, this Folsom Prison graduate, stands up and he takes the kitchen chair. We're in the kitchen in the recovery house. He bangs it down on the floor and he says, for Christ's sake, will somebody start talking about the insanity of alcoholism? He says, all I've been hearing is stories about how goofy drunks are when they're drunk. He says, unless you can get this, you haven't got the first hope of sobriety. And, you know, again, I still didn't know what the hell he was talking about. So a couple of days later, you know, I'm passing by the office and Walter's in there, you know, and I say, are you feeling any better today, Walter? You know, kind of, you know, real dork, you know. And Walter says, you know, he says, I still don't think after 2.5 years you even know what we're talking about yet, about step one or insanity. And he says, let me take you through your last relapse, just, you know, a week or so before. He says, let me get this right. You had not drunk anything or used any drugs for 7 months. Right. And then you got in your car this day and you drove up to the liquor store, right?
Right.
Was there any alcohol or drugs in you when you got to the liquor store?
No.
You go into the store, you pull down this bottle, Dickel, I think you said it was.
Yeah, Dickel.
You took it up to the man and you paid him. Was there any alcohol or drugs in you at this point?
No.
And you drove home then. And you went into your room and you opened the bottle. And you put it in the glass and he took his coffee cup. And he says, okay, you put some in a glass and you raise it to your mouth and he did this. He says, and as it's on its way up, is there any alcohol or drugs in you yet?
No.
Okay, and then you do this. And as the alcohol trickles down here, you say, damn, that alcohol, as soon as it entered my body, I began to act irrationally. I began to act irrationally after that alcohol entered my body. He says, you need to be goddamn crazy to believe that. He says, if you don't believe you were crazy when you got in your car, if you don't believe you were crazy when you went to the liquor store, if you don't believe you were crazy when you pulled down that bottle and paid for it and drove back, if you believe you only started acting crazy after that stuff trickled down your throat, you are fucking nuts. That's exactly his word. He said, you were crazy as a loon long before, because he said every one of us who ever relapsed, who had been sober, every one of us who ever relapsed, we took the first drink or drug clean and sober. So don't go blaming the entry of that drug into your body for the beginning of your insanity. You are acting insane long before it ever got in there. And, you know, and then he took me through this book here. And he pointed out stuff. He pointed out, I don't know if you remember that story about the accountant who went to Washington, D.C. You remember that story? And he had been sober for quite a while. And he says, you know, and he removed all these pop psychology things. You know, I've spent the last 30 years being a therapist. But, you know, the kind of questions, you know, if you have a relapse and you go into the therapist and they say, maybe were you feeling well that day? Maybe you weren't out of town before. Maybe this was a new experience for you. Maybe your business wasn't coming off well. Maybe you were disappointed. Maybe there was something negative going on in your life. That's why you relapsed. You know, in 1939, these crazy old alcoholics answered every one of those questions because they said that, he said, I've been out of town, here it is, I've been out of town before during this particular dry spell. So there's nothing new about that. Physically, I felt fine. Neither did I have any pressing problems or worries. My business came off well. I was pleased and knew my partners would be too. It was the end of a perfect day, not a cloud on the horizon. And then the book goes into italics, right? And why does it go into italics? Because it's trying to make the point. It says, I went to my hotel room, leisurely dressed for dinner. As I crossed the threshold of the dining room, the thought came to mind that it would be nice to have a couple of cocktails with my dinner. That was all, nothing more. I ordered the cocktails as casually as if they were ginger ale. And then he goes on to explain that no matter what they had told him, they had all said that no matter what they knew about alcohol, it would be of no avail in those strange mental blank spots that we have. Strange mental blank spots. And Walter went over this, and he finally wound up with that thing. You know the scary page 43, the bottom of the page? Once more, the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink. And they say it again, you know, they say it before that in page 24, 20, 23 or 24. It says, at certain times we have no defense against the first drink. I thought it was that it was only after I took the first one I had no defense. No, it's saying something. And I stood there in Walter's office and I said, do you mean to tell me that standing here with nothing in me, I have no defense against the first drink? He said, that's what the book says, and that's what we've all experienced. And I literally got shivers. I was scared, because for the first time, step one dawned on me, what it meant. And I said, do you realize, Walter, what you have just been saying? You know, that if that's the case, you know what you're trying to say? You're trying to say that I'm standing here right now. He says, does powerless cover it? He says, where do you think we came up with the word, you know? Why do you think we said that? We are absolutely powerless. And, you know, and that then began to make sense, that it is because of this powerlessness, even when I'm sober, that I need the kind of program that we're in. And the deal is made pretty clear. My protection, my only protection against this chip that is somehow badly wired up here, there's a flaw in it. It gives me crazy answers occasionally. Sometimes it doesn't warn me. I can order a drink as casually as ginger ale. I can do something that will set me off and destroy my entire life, and I can do it as casually as, you know, spitting, you know? And because I am insane about drugs and alcohol when I'm clean and sober. And my only protection against it is this deal. And the deal is, as made very clear in the big book of AA and in the 12 by 12 and the experience of all these alcoholics, and that is, the deal is this: I am saved from this insanity on a daily basis contingent upon the fact that I have turned my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood it. That's the deal. And as it says, kind of scary in the big book, it says, if you are as seriously alcoholic as we were, we believe there is no middle of the road solution. In other places they say half measures availed us nothing, but I like the there is no middle of the road solution, page 24. Because that's a fact. I tried middle of the road. A lot of people here have tried middle of the road. You know, it's not the same as painting a wall. You paint half a wall, you got half a wall painted. You do half a program, you got nothing. You know, it's just, there's no middle of the road. And so, you know, if somebody promotes this as some sort of a cute way of not using alcohol or drugs, this is no cute way to not do it. It's not some trick that alcoholics learned, you know. This is rather radical. This is no cute way to not do it. It's not some trick that alcoholics learned, you know. This is rather radical. They're saying, hey, you want to be protected from this insanity? What it calls for is you turn your will and your life over to the care of God as you understand him, and you don't take it back. And that's what the whole program from then on is about. And, you know, I had not, you know, I went back one of the times after that last time I relapsed, I went to a meeting I used to always go to before, and there was one guy who used to piss me off. He was one of these old World War II vets, you know, with a crew cut, and he just loved razzing a priest, you know. And he was an agnostic, and he used to come up and, you know, get right in my face and say, you know, I'm an agnostic. What about you? And I've got 15 years sober, and you got 15 days, you know. And he said to me one time, he says, did you take the second step? of AA, which is we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And I said, well, yeah, but I've always believed in God. And he says, so what has that got to do with anything? He says, in my big book, it says, we came to believe, and there's no, like, parenthesis that says, unless, of course, you're already a priest. It says, we came to believe. And he says, I said, but I've always believed in God. And he says, well, let me ask you this. If you were some man, he said, and you got this job of selling Tylenol around the country, around the territory, and you were a great Tylenol salesman, and you know why? Because you had studied it, and you saw the reports, and the lab reports, and the, you know, outcomes and everything, and you said, you know, damn, this is a product I could sell, because I really believe in it. And you go out, and you sell this Tylenol all over the place, and you do a great job, until one day, you get a bad headache. And you go back to your motel room, you know, and you dig down through your briefcase, and in your briefcase you've got all these free Tylenol samples, right, that you give out to people. And down in the bottom of your briefcase there's this little tin box with Bayer aspirin in it, and you take 2 Bayer aspirin and a glass of water. He says, tell me this, what do you believe in? What does that man believe in? Well, he probably believes in what he uses for his own pain. He says, okay, you go over to your church, right? And what do you do in your church? You pray, God, you are my refuge. You are my strength. You're my hope, my salvation, my consolation. You are my shepherd, my this and my that. And then he says, what do? You go back to your room, and you take a glass, and you pour alcohol into it. And that is your refuge and your strength and your hope and your consolation. And he says, what do you believe in? He says, I think, Father, you ought to maybe look at the second step, you know. But it took me only about 6 weeks to get over being pissed off at him. Insulting a priest like that, you know. but you know, I eventually had to admit that, you know, the fact is, I had come to believe in liquor and pills of various kinds, because they are what I use to get through the day. They're what I use for my refuge, my strength, my hope, my, you know, all of those things that we were talking about. And so I had to start off where a lot of people in this, you know, recovery business have to start off. We have to find some kind of power that we can believe in. I just got through doing a retreat up in Santa Cruz, and you know, even though I haven't been a priest now for 30 years, but I still do retreat with this Jesuit occasionally, and he tore his Achilles tendon, so he called me a couple of weeks ago, so I went up, and but I was trying to figure out how I'd get across this idea, you know, of coming to believe in some power greater than ourselves. And so I went over to the Home Depot, and they were selling tulip bulbs and daffodil bulbs and crocus bulbs. So I bought about 50 or 60 of those, because there's like 55 people on the retreat. And I went around and I gave everybody a bulb. I told them, you don't know what it is. You know how you're going to find out what it is? You're going to find out in the spring. And there's no point in you getting pissed off at it and telling it you wanted to be a rose, or you wanted to be a this or a that. If it's a daffodil, it's not going to be a crocus. It's going to be whatever it is. And why is that? Because right inside of that bulb, there is some kind of a principle of life, or a force, right? And that force is in there, and you're just going to have to trust it. And the reason I said that is because it may not sound like much of a spiritual awakening that I had, but one, I finally moved out of San Francisco after living there for a number of years, and I bought a little house that had a little side yard, and I busted up the ground, and I put in some topsoil, and I planted zucchini and tomatoes and beans and a few things like that. And it wasn't half the size of this room. But I remember standing there on a Sunday afternoon, you know, looking at the nice dark earth and the new, you know, plants in there. And I remember thinking to myself, you know, the only one living thing that's standing in this garden that I don't trust to produce its proper fruit or whatever is this one here. I'm not lecturing the tomatoes and saying, you know, I don't want to see any beefsteaks on you cherry tomatoes. I don't want to see any beans on you corn, you know. If I see beans growing on you, you're in trouble, you know. Or, you know, I don't lecture the zucchini, you know, and say, I don't want any yellow squash on you guys, you know. And, you know, it's like, why is that? Because these are living things, and inside of every living thing, whether it's an acorn has the oak inside it, right? You don't have to tell it how to become an oak. Well, you know, I think what the program is saying to us is it's saying that we need to trust this power, this life force that is inside of us. And, you know it's there because, you know, you're going to Catholic and Episcopalian churches, there'll be a little light burning up, a little red lamp up, you know, and tells you God is present, you know. Well, you know, you want to know if God's present, just take your pulse, you know. Because when that stops, somebody left, you know. Okay, you know, so you've got a life force inside you that knows a hell of a lot better what you're supposed to be than you do. Because you, meaning your conscious mind, mostly hasn't got a clue. It discovers afterward. You know, most of us who are here in recovery aren't here because we're so damn bright. We got here by accident. We got here by desperation. We got here, you know, through, you know, just good fortune. But we did not get here because we were so damn smart. So, you know, I think what we're being asked to do in this program is we're being asked to trust something that we know is there, we can feel it, we know it's there, we know that when it leaves we're not worth anything, they just bury the remains or burn them or something, you know, we're the remains then. So as long as this force is inside of each one of us, this is what we have to learn to trust. And, you know, it's not that big a deal. A bunch of us went out on Saturday, 2 weeks ago, over to La Jolla, over to the, what do you call it, the glider port. Have you been over there? You know, it's like, you know, 300 feet sheer down to Jack's Beach, or Black's Beach down below, right? And, right? Okay. So here's a bunch of alcoholics, and we're sitting there at, you know, having our breakfast, and we're watching these guys, you know, with their hang gliders, right? And they're going, you know, and they're saying, well, you know, I see the wind out there, you know, it's like, you see the ripples? Okay, the wind is still about 10 minutes off the coast, you know. About 10 minutes, we'll have wind, right? 10 minutes, we'll have wind. So these guys, you know, are getting their sails ready. They got all the webbing, they got all the lines and everything, and they're kind of testing them and all. And then what do? They run down the end, down to the end of this lawn, and they launch themselves into the air. And I turned to this guy beside me and I said, "Shit, we thought the third step was hard, man." You know, you know, here they're trusting something that they can't really see. They can know by certain signs that it's there, but they launch their lives out, you know, 300 feet above the beach, you know, on these stupid big sails, you know. And we're sitting there going, you know, well, I don't know whether I could make the decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of this God, as I understand. You know, that just sounds really risky, you know. Like, man, that's radical, you know. And, you know, here's these guys, you know, for fun, man. They're jumping off the edge of the cliff, you know, and trusting in this wind, you know. And, man, it's a heart stopper to watch even, because they go over the edge. And they drop like about, you know, 20 or 30 feet first before the thermal gets them, you know. It's like, wow. During that 20 minutes, I'd have died. Or 20 feet, I'd have died, you know. It's like, God. So, you know, so this is essentially the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, maybe you haven't heard it put this way before, but, you know. But, you know, it's not as radical as it sounds. What we're being asked to do is, this conscious mind of ours has royally messed up our lives. It failed. The war is over. We lost. You know. So, you know, now we do this. Now we trust a power that is competent, that has been with us since the moment we were born, that is, you know, when it leaves, we're gone, you know, and we're just saying, I am going to trust this. And when people say to me sometimes, you know, because, I had to kind of get, you know, I'll just touch on that in a minute, but, you know, when people say to me, you know, you're not a priest anymore, do you have any faith? And I said, yeah, I got more faith now than I ever had in my life. And they said, well, how do you mean? I said, well, you know something? I got as much faith in this now as I do in a zucchini. And that might not sound like a whole lot, but you know what I mean? That's a whole lot of faith. Because I'm not lecturing myself. I'm not saying, why aren't you, you know, why don't you win a Nobel Prize? Why aren't you a great poet or a great musician? I mean, that's like saying to your zucchini, you know, why aren't you a rose bush? You know, why aren't you something that will earn a lot of money? You know, I mean, we are what we are. And, you know, it's about time for all of us to say to ourselves, you know, it's you and me, kid. You're what I got. And I'm going to be on your side from now on. And I'm going to quit riding you. And I think this is like one of the biggest things that has happened to me is that kind of, it's a kind of a spiritual awakening for me with the idea that I am a living thing too. And inside of me is the same kind of force that, I mean, people have been talking about this for thousands of years. I mean, I don't mean to preach religion to anybody because I'm not particularly, you know, wedded to anyone at the moment. Many of us, you know, have gone to Sunday schools and, you know, catechism classes or whatever, you know, and there's so many people probably here, you know, had the Sermon on the Mount shoved down their throat at one time or another, right? You know, but if you just listen to it, you know, I'm going to quote you a little bit of it, you know, I'm not preaching to you. But what it says is, in a kind of modern English, here's what it says. It says, about your life, don't be anxious what you will wear, what you will eat, or where you will live. Your Heavenly Father already knows you need these things and has made provision for them. Look at the lilies of the field. Not even King Solomon in all his glory was dressed as well as one of them. And in one week, it's a weed. So seek first the power of God that is inside of you and what it would have you do. And all these other things will be added on to you besides. I mean, shit, this is not new stuff. This wasn't discovered in 1935 when AA was founded. This has been around. Probably people that know other religious traditions probably know, you know, equal statements from thousands of years back. Because for thousands of years, people just like us have, you know, come into adulthood and wondered, what in the hell am I supposed to do? How am I supposed to find out? And, you know, I think that to know that you have on board as a living thing, you have a guidance system that can't be beat. You just have to start getting in touch with it and listening to it. In fact, you know, when I was in this first drying out joint up in Sonoma County, the old guy that ran it, you know, had great sobriety. He was really a good guy, and he was trying to help a lot of, you know, really dumb young people like me, you know. And, I mean, he wasn't having much of a chance because, you know, I remember him saying to me one day when I showed up, you know, he knew that I was, like, in my third year of my doctoral program, and he says, oh, you're an intellectual. I said, well, I looked in his eye. I knew he didn't, you know, wasn't a compliment. And I said, what do you mean by that? He says, well, in my book, an intellectual is anybody who's educated way beyond their capacity. You know, so, but anyway, you know, he used to try to, you know, tell us about, don't make AA like some kind of, you know, out there discipline or religion or something. He said, AA is just a program that helps people find out what they're supposed to do with their lives. And that's, you know, kind of, that's the primary kind of You know, the primary purpose is to get sober and stay sober. But the goal of the 12 steps, he was very clear to distinguish, and he would say, so what's the goal of the 12 steps, you know? And I remember, you know, the goal of the 12 steps is to get you sober. He says, no, the goal of the 12 steps, that's the primary purpose, but the goal of the 12 steps, he said, is in step 11. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood it, praying only for one thing. Praying for knowledge of what we should do with our lives. In other words, to find out, am I a zucchini? Am I a yellow squash? Am I a bean? Am I a corn? Am I, what the hell am I? Praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. That's step 11. That's where we're heading when we set out in step 3 to turn our will and our lives over. And, you know, the rest of the program in between is removing the rocks, getting the snails out of the garden, you know, so that we have a chance to grow into what it is we can and are intended to be. And I think that for me, you know, it became kind of clear after a while that I really wasn't very good at being a priest. And some of the things priests were not supposed to do, I was doing. And that's about all I will share at a group level. So I decided I would leave and get married. I went in and I resigned, and I remember telling the bishop I would stop pretending to be a priest, and he said, well, I'll stop pretending, I'm paying you. They were paying us $65 a month at the time, you know, and so we kind of parted on good enough terms. And you know, that was again a kind of part of my recovery, because my sponsor, this old priest, you know, was with me in this, and you know, he said, you know, Seamus, he said, I don't know, I think you've got to make some decisions, you know, you just need to get your life honest and get things cleared up, and you know, and I knew what he meant, you know, and he knew how complicated my life was at that point. And so you know, I think that when we're talking about recovery, unfortunately sometimes AA is preached at us in a way that makes us feel like it's some kind of religion or some kind of thing that somebody else wants us to do. But, you know, I just hope that, you know, if you hear anything in what I'm saying tonight, that the most important thing, I think, would be this program is really a program of removing your confusion as what the hell to do with your life. And it also is a program in which you are protected from the insanity of your own mind, which leads you back to drinking. But it is both those. There's no middle of the road. I think that I'd like to end with a little quote from the Big Book, which I just think says, you know, what most of us who have found some continuous sobriety would say. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do by ourselves. I still go to I do not want to go back to being as confused and messed up as I was 31 years ago. And for that reason, I'm very pleased to be here tonight. Thank you.
When I woke up this morning, I didn't think